You know, South Australia is the drunken uncle of Australia. But there's things about your drunken uncle that actually he's a really fucking nice guy that lives in a beautiful house.
Welcome to this episode of the Ingredients Podcast. And we're here in Africola. And today we sat down with Duncan and Lauren to talk about this amazing venue, their journey in the Adelaide hospitality scene, and how they became the first venue to have wood oven here in Adelaide. And also, how the book got on the bear as well. We hope you enjoy the podcast. This episode of the Ingredients Podcast is brought to you by Tanda, the team helping venues stay ahead of the game. Now, if you want to run a great venue, but also stay compliant at the same time, go to hospitality@tanda.com.au. The link is in the bio in the show notes. Let's get into the podcast. Thanks for being on the Ingredients Podcast, guys. Great to have you both here inside your own venue. Duncan and Lauren. Let's maybe start out with how you both individually started out in the industry and then how we got to this point where you're both working together here at Africola. So maybe, Duncan, do you want to start? But the five-minute version of how you got into hospitality.
I grew up in a hospitality family. My dad was a chef, owned restaurants and stuff in Johannesburg. And, you know, being a hospo baby, you're kind of always around it. I had no intention of ever being in the industry until I moved to London when I was about 17 years old and lost all my money in a strip club 6 hours off the plane. Okay. I mean, we got scammed. If anyone's ever been to Leicester Square and there's a little dodgy, we were just looking for a beer and ended up losing all of my money. So basically had a return ticket on the tube, could only get me as far as South Ken. I was living in Earls Court. So I got out, walked the streets, found a job, sort of sign saying, you know, chef de party wanted. And I walked in and got the job immediately.
Wow.
Yeah. I was at a restaurant called La Boucher. And I thought I was just, you know, magnificent at selling myself because I knew nothing. Unfortunately, they employed me because there happened to be a pretty intense, violent kitchen and they didn't have any staff. So, so that was my introduction to sort of hospitality. I didn't last very long there. I think only maybe 3 months before the head chef wanted to murder me and took a job at a little pub restaurant called The Goose at Britwell Saloon, which I knew nothing about. I was second chef under a chef called Michael North, who is a legend there. And, you know, he didn't have a Michelin star at the time. It was just, he was 23. I think I just turned 18 or was just about to turn 18. The pub itself was owned by a guy called Chris Barber, who was the personal chef to Prince Charles and Princess Diana. So after the dissolution of the royal household, this was his first business. So it was incredibly high profile as well. This was just in a place called Britwell Saloon in Oxfordshire. I was second chef in that kitchen and, you know, it was just the two of us, no kitchen hands, no nothing, working 7 days a week, working all the sections. I had no real training or experience, but learnt sort of, really, really hard, really fast. And as soon as, you know, I started to experience things like, you know, truffles and seps and salsify and foie gras, it made me completely obsessive about the industry, and the rest is history.
And how did you come to Adelaide?
I met my partner in England. She was from Adelaide. She was born and bred in Moonta, regional South Australia. We got married in Adelaide, went back to the UK, found out she was pregnant and sort of decided that, you know, Europe, I didn't really want to bring a child up in Europe. It was still unfamiliar to me to an extent. It's not my childhood. And South Africa, wasn't really an option. So we thought, okay, well, you know, let's come to Australia and straight to Adelaide in 2010.
So then you're celebrating 10 years here now, right? Around 10 years at Africa?
11.
11?
Yeah, 11 and a half.
So then you had a couple of years of being here before Africa.
Correct.
Right? So what did you do during that time? So
my first job in Adelaide, because restaurant jobs were, particularly in 2010, very few and far between, unless I wanted to be a cafe chef at the local coffee shop. And having worked, you know, 1 to 3 Michelin stars, having, you know, I've been a head chef of a Michelin star restaurant for 4 years, it wasn't something that sort of excited me. So the first job I took was executive chef of the Royal Agricultural Society slash the Adelaide Showgrounds, which I thought was a pretty crazy thing to do. I didn't really, you know, it was just a job. You know, my wife was about to give birth. They were paying really well. So I didn't actually consider what that job taught me. You know, I'd gotten to a point in restaurants where there's only so much you can learn. You know, you become a mise en place machine. You know, you can structure a kitchen. You can learn all that sort of stuff. But there was nothing completely out of my comfort zone to really learn until I worked there. So, you know, my first event a week into the job was a cocktail party for ATE, Australian Tourism Expo, which was about 2,500 people. So from going to, from, you know, maximum 120 covers to 2,500 covers, your brain completely has to change. And then, you know, and then straight into Big Day Out, looking after all the bands backstage. And then, you know, the Adelaide show, which, you know, brings hundreds of thousands of people in a week, running all the corporate and the members, plus all the private dinners and lunches and functions for the Royal Agricultural Society. So, you know, you're working with millions of dollars worth of produce, you know, staffing, you know, up to 100 people of this onslaught of 2 weeks, you know. So what it taught me was, you know, I can build a kitchen pretty much anywhere. And, you know, understanding how festivals and large-scale events can happen, coupled with the fact that, you know, obviously had a real keen eye for attention to detail. It absolutely did wonders for how we operate today.
Did it obviously build a lot of connections with bands and like big touring groups and that kind of stuff
at
that point as well?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when bands go on tour, particularly from a catering aspect, chefs don't really give a fuck. I mean, unless they really like the band, or even then, sure. You know, they're not restaurant chefs working in these big places or in catering operations, right? So it's always down to, there's no love in it. It's always down to the bottom line from the promoters or the TMs or whatever it is. I was lucky at that Big Day Out. There were a lot of bands I really loved. They had a really bad run with catering and dressing room and riders and all the things that, you know, bands actually look forward to, because it's, you know, it is pretty tough on the road.
Yeah.
So I was just like, fuck, I know all these bands. I love all of them. I actually know what they like and what they don't like. Mm-hmm. And really turned it on. And from that, that was the kind of start with our connection to that world. And, you know, lucky enough to call a lot of those bands my friends today.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Then fast forward into how Africola became what it is. Like, how did you get the opportunity to take on this site?
Myself and my business partner, James Brown, who's an artist, pretty famous artist, we were doing festivals and festival activations. And we had just finished our festival called Lola's Pergola, which was a club for Adelaide Festival, mm-hmm. Which was a massive undertaking and doing something no one had really ever done in Australia before. You know, showcasing natural wine, showcasing, well, minimal intervention wine, sorry, not natural wine, minimal intervention wines, the winemakers themselves, hospitality, new Australian hospitality, to an audience that, you know, would have never really experienced it before, from a wide range of demographics. You know, so it was a massive success. And after that, we thought, well, fuck it. I was a chef at a restaurant called Bistro Dom, which had won quite a few awards and, you know, everything else. But I was kind of needing to get out of there to do my own thing. Yeah, we kind of found the site and signed the lease, and there we go.
Cool. Yeah. I want to talk about that, obviously, in more detail and about that feeling when you first opened. But, Lauren, can we go to you? And, like, how did you come to be part of this amazing restaurant? Like, in doing the research about you, like, you've worked at a lot of my favorite venues in Melbourne, and like, Cumulus being probably the top note for me. But how did it come to be that you started out as a chef and then came over to Adelaide?
I was a bit later to start. I was sort of 20, 21. And I'd been at uni in Melbourne and absolutely hated it. I'd fall asleep in classes. You know, it just wasn't for me. I needed something sort of more active. So sort of at a loose end and moved back to Bendigo, which is my hometown. During that time, I picked up, you know, call centre work. I just didn't know what I wanted to do. When I was 21, I lost my brother, and I got given an opportunity to take a redundancy at the call centre I was working at. So I was like, sweet, I bought myself a bit of time. Yes. So I was like, what should I do next? And got into washing dishes. And I thought, this is just a, you know, an in-between job, but I found myself becoming more and more involved with the chefs that were working there. And then, yeah, decided to start my apprenticeship. Within a week of doing that, I'd moved to Melbourne and started working at Rumi, which is Lygon Street, East Brunswick, still there now. I was there for 4 years, got a year and a half into doing my apprenticeship and ended up being sous chef there. So I never technically finished my training, but it hasn't really mattered too much. After that, did a few little bits and pieces, worked for Taco Truck in Melbourne when they first started up, and then went to Cumulus, which was good but extremely hectic. And that sort of was the reason I moved to Adelaide, because I was just working too much. Melbourne became insane. You know, many, many hours a week that, you know, I just didn't have a life. So decided to move to Adelaide. And, yeah, that was, I think, 8 years ago. Did a cafe job for a bit, hated it. And then, yeah, started at Africola 7 years ago.
Wow. 7 years, wow.
Yeah. Been in 7 years, just clocked 7 years.
Congratulations.
Cool, long service day. Amazing.
Let's read it. I quit.
You know, you're saying that Melbourne was hectic, and especially coming from like Bendigo, I can imagine why you think that, because obviously I'm from Adelaide originally, but have lived all around the country in like 10 years in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And the reason why we moved was Melbourne was becoming hectic for me, really.
Yeah.
What did you learn from Cumulus? Because Cumulus is like, it is a beast. Yeah. It has been there for, it's an institution. It's run by, you know, one of the best groups in Melbourne, being Andrew McConnell with Trader House. Mm-hmm. Like, what did that teach you about that next level of chef?
It taught me how to manage my stress. And also, it's a dog eat dog world sometimes in that industry. And if you don't have yourself sorted, you know, you're going down.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then when you came here, like, so how did it come that you actually came to work here? Like, how did you guys connect up?
Well, it's a funny story, actually. The cafe that I was working at when I first started here, there was a barista that worked here, and he was pretty keen to become a chef. So I knew about Africola. I knew about other restaurants. I'd eaten here before. And I said, look, there's probably only one place you should put your resume in. And I said, Africola. So when I say put your resume in, I wrote his resume and his cover letter. And he got a job here as a first-year apprentice. And then I get a call from him one day saying, they need a chef to party. You should apply. And so, yeah, I came in, did a trial, got the job that day. And that's how I started here.
Wow. What did you notice about the difference between Africola and other venues you'd worked in before in Victoria?
There's just a completely different vibe. You know, the idea, look, I'd always worn chef jackets in other places. Came in here, everyone's wearing a T-shirt. But that didn't, you know, I learned very quickly wearing a T-shirt or wearing a chef jacket didn't mean anything in particular. So there were lots of women in the kitchen here as well when I started, not as many as there are now, but I really enjoyed the idea of having a female head chef because I'd had that before at Rumi and that, I don't know, it's a different kind of learning and relationship. So that was a real draw card for me here. You know, the elements of smoking, the wood oven, you know, I touched on cooking with coal, but, you know, just the different cooking methods that I hadn't seen before in other restaurants, like especially Cumulus, it's very like, you know, sous vide, Paco jets, you know, all of that kind of stuff. This was more sort of actual cooking, which I'd missed from my time working at Rumi.
So did you feel you had to think more by working here?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. You're not reliant on, you know, thermometers or, you know, temperatures. It's about using your intuition when you're cooking and, you know, using all your senses. So that's what really struck me when I first came in here.
Duncan, when you first opened the restaurant, was it always going to be a South African restaurant? Did you ever think about doing another type of cuisine?
Not really. I didn't really think. I don't think anyone thinks about the restaurant before they open a restaurant. you know, the reason it's called Africola is because it's named after the German soft drink company. And my business partner, James, who was laid up in hospital in Darwin for falling off a skateboard, kind of was watching a documentary, which was the When We Were Kings documentary, Muhammad Ali versus George Foreman. And one of the main sponsors was Africola. And he was like, oh, we should do a festival called Africola. When we got the site, we were like, well, what the fuck are we going to do? Like, I don't know, food, you know, literally no thinking. And he was like, oh, you know, we want to do a festival like Africola. Why don't we call it Africola? I'm like, yeah, I could, you know, I could really lean into my heritage and everything else. And what you find when you try to do a cultural or a heritage-based restaurant is that unless you are ultra, ultra, ultra authentic, don't fucking do it at all. So this is probably one of the most inauthentic restaurants in the world because you're never gonna cook better than someone's grandmother, right?
Yeah.
Always gonna be like, oh, you know, my mum does it better than you or whatever it is. Is like, fuck off. Well, you know, instead of doing a version of it, we're just gonna make a kind of new cuisine, you know, African accented, but using all our techniques, you know, that we've learned along the way through the various kitchens and the various repertoires. I mean, you know, Africola isn't necessarily what I cook or is my repertoire. It's just one of them and is a product.
Sure.
Yeah.
Were you always going to cook over fire? Because 11 years ago, you would have been only one of a handful of restaurants who were really doing that at that stage.
Pretty much one of the only.
Yeah.
Unlike some restaurants claim to be the only ones that do it in the history of Adelaide.
Right.
We were like, we were burning down our kitchen way before you step foot. In fact, two fucking fires. Reality. It's like, no, you're not really, are you? The thing is, I mean, cooking over fire is how we cook in South Africa.
Right.
You know, we have a braai, and a braai constitutes at least, I don't know, 9 times out of 10, how we actually cook our meals. You know, it's one of the very few glues that hold our country together, to be fair. So it was remiss of me not to put in a wood fire grill / wood oven as well into my kitchen. We obviously had to make a few adjustments after burning our restaurant down twice.
Yeah.
So, you know, we find where we, you know, the fire element is taken into other places, or it's very concentrated, or used actually a little bit better than just chucking something on the grill.
Yep. I know from like the work that we do in running hospitality teams for a while myself, one of the reasons why venues do really well is they have that connection between a long-standing head chef or a venue manager, and that's how they grow their business, how they do more venues, that's how they do more things with their brand. But you've remained as one restaurant, but then doing curation of events and those kind of different things. Because you've been here for 7 years, that's a long time for a head chef to be in a position of power. Why have you not done 5 Africolas?
Because, you know what, it's like, you know, and it's not through lack of people offering or, you know, developers saying take it to Melbourne, take it to Sydney, take it to Perth, whatever. Even abroad, you know, we were in talks to take it to Singapore or Dubai, actually. But it's saturating what makes a place, you know. For us, it's about the people, and it always has been about the people, you know. Moving a team... Or dilution only works in drinks, not in product, in my opinion. And, you know, Africola exists because it's a sum of a whole bunch of moving parts. Mm-hmm. So I've never been interested in doing multiple restaurants, you know, outside of these four walls, to be honest. It's hard enough making a restaurant be successful. You know, I'm not keen on having more fucking headaches. I've got enough of them in my life, so... You know?
I also think the good thing about Africola is it feels like 5 restaurants in one, you know, in terms of the variety of things we get to do. That's why I'm still here after 7 years, because one year isn't the same. 6 months isn't the same. One day isn't even the same, you know. It's like with all the events we get to do, you know, the opportunities that we have to do, you know, other little bits and pieces that you would never get at another restaurant. And also, you know, we talk about the different cooking techniques, Nick. I've been here for 7 years and we've had a clean out of the kitchen and all new equipment put in maybe 3 or 4 times, which means you have to change and adapt your menu and your cooking techniques to what's in the kitchen. You know, we had tandoors for a while, you know, like cooking, you know, they were a nightmare, like big metal sticks with chickens in there.
It's wow,
like,
okay.
Yeah, it was another fire hazard.
It's constantly, I mean, the product constantly evolves. You know, the market constantly evolves, you know, and I think, like, for us, we are constantly improving every aspect of what makes this experience. You know, we don't rest on our laurels, but you know, there's constant maintenance, there's tradies fucking everywhere every single day, and we keep going over the menu and the product and the team and the culture constant, you know.
Everything changes, but what we try not to change is the core team of people.
Yeah,
you know, restaurants are a living, breathing organism that you have to manage, and you can't call it in or be an absentee landlord, even though sometimes I feel I can be quite an absentee landlord with everything that goes on, but it's making it interesting for the team at all times. Yeah, you know, and we're lucky enough to have put, you know, people through law school and, you know, getting, you know, all their degrees, starting families, buying houses. So we...
Training chefs that go on to
do amazing things, yeah. Like... You know, so being, you know, being that place that is now fully invested in the community, not just opening up a restaurant and feeding some people, it's, you know, people celebrate their lives here, you know, people, you know, have they get engaged and have their weddings here, you know. So when you start a restaurant, those sort of things don't ever come into your mind. You just think, fuck, I want to impress a food critic and be busy enough, and that's you know, that's what it is. And it's like a real restaurant has so much more impact within your community than all that other fucking bullshit that does not matter in the slightest, because that's all bullshit, it's all fake, you know?
So what do you concentrate on the most, just the experience that you're delivering every day to guests, and that's it?
No, I think there's a fifth, I mean, we concentrate on supporting our producers, we concentrate on making a fun and great environment for our team.
Yep.
You know, in fact, that's probably first and foremost, because everything comes from that. You know, our team, you know, in time more passionate than I am. In fact, probably most of the time more passionate than I am, you know, that they're excited to be here. They love being here. And then, you know, if we're excited about what we're cooking and, you know, the team has all that love for the venue and themselves and the rest of the team, that flows into the customer experience naturally. It's an organic thing. You know, if no one wants to be here and it's all shit and it's just another day at the fucking office, yeah. No one gives it, like, you can eat that, you can taste that, you know, it's a tangible thing. So, you know, that for us, we've never picked up Gourmet Traveler and gone, how to do a cool restaurant? Yeah. Oh, what's in the season? You know, like, fuck that shit in the face. Like, it means nothing. It means anyone opening up a fucking restaurant, fuck that shit off. It means nothing. It has to come from what you actually want to do, how you want to support your team, how you want to support the people that grow your food or make your wine. And then the restaurant will write its own story.
I love that. Lauren, how do you build a menu and keep that authenticity? Because I imagine you do have obviously a collection of producers who you use all the time. I imagine you've used for a long period of time. But you'd also get a lot of different producers who would hit you up all the time,
yep.
Go and try this, what do you think of this, what do you think of this? Like, are you constantly in ideation about changing the menu, or is it a seasonal thing for you guys?
Well, we reprint the menu every day. So
wow, okay.
Doesn't mean that it changes entirely every day. It just means we can every day revisit something, tweak something. Duncan and I will chat. He'll be like, I want this off. And I'll be like, yep, no worries. Like, you know, it can be as simple as that. But all of those things come into account. And we just constantly every day tweaking to try and make a dish better, look better, easier to execute, any sort of thing. So we have that that flexibility with the menu. Yeah. But obviously whatever's in season we'll use, but that's, you know.
Every restaurant should do that.
Yes, exactly. You know. But, you know, there's, you know, we think about things, you know, what's in season now? When can we use this if we apply a technique to it? Or what's not in season? How can we make that, you know, an amazing dish, you know? Yeah.
Is it hard to train your kitchen team that much when you are reverse engineering everything all the time?
Not really, because it's a collaborative effort. You know, obviously with Duncan, you know, steering the ship, but no, it happens organically. So, yeah.
And I think the team's enthusiastic enough to jump onto it, you know, and that's very important as well. It's like
you've got a
willing and hungry team. That makes all the difference, you know.
They can bring things to your attention if they're not liking something, or, you know, they'll let us know.
How do you keep everyone informed in the team about what's going on when there is so much changing in real time in a really cool way? Like, are you doing methodically, like, meetings every day? Obviously meetings every day with your team and that kind of stuff. But, like, is there anything just to keep the whole team abreast of what's happening with Africola as a brand?
Well, we all work together all day, every day, basically. So it's, you know, conversations throughout the day, conversations before service, during service. It's, you know, just... Yeah. We're just constantly talking to each other. And if you wanted to say, how do we formally keep in contact, I guess we have WhatsApp and it's like, this is what this is, mm-hmm. what we've landed on sort of thing, just so there's a reference for something. But it's all just chat in the kitchen.
How do you find the best team members to work here? Is it hard?
We employ on personality.
Yeah.
And that is it. We don't employ on skill, we employ on personality. We can teach skill. But we can't teach you from being a fuckhead, you know, in the nicest possible way.
Yeah.
You know, we've got a extremely low staff turnover, touch wood.
How?
Just building culture. Like, how many people do we employ? Probably, I don't know, 25, 30, mm-hmm. 30, something like that. And like I said, everyone's here because they want to be here. If you don't want to be here, we can feel that almost immediately. And we know pretty much from day one that it's probably not going to, you know, and it's not through lack of support or lack of making an effort with a team member. you just know, you know, it's you know, we get flogged every single service here. So, you know, there is, you know, you do have to have your wits about you. You do have to have a little bit of common sense and just be chill, you know, and just be happy. You know, and like, we'll do absolutely anything and everything for our staff here. I mean, we really do go above and beyond, because we value our team members. But if you don't work out, it's a very quick shift, you know?
Fair enough. It's a quick trial and you'll sort of know.
It's a quick trial. And it is based on personality.
Yeah. Most of the time, these people will remove themselves from the situation.
Sure.
It's not...
They can feel it.
Sorry?
They can feel it. Like, yeah. They're not part of it. Yeah.
But I don't want it to sound culty or anything.
No. But that energy,
you know,
right?
They'll know if they're the
they're
right
not sacrificing
fit.
Goats.
Yeah.
By 2 p.m., you know.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys. It's probably not going to work out.
Because you both have been in Adelaide for, you know, around the decade each. How have you seen the industry change in Adelaide since that time? Because I think the reason why we're trying to do these episodes in Adelaide is to really showcase the Adelaide hospitality scene where it is at the moment, as opposed to the East Coast or even in Perth. But how have you seen it evolve and change since you've been here?
Well, I think when I got here, it was pretty, as I said, plastic fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, Adelaide used to be the centre of cooking in Australia. And then became pretty devoid of it to an extent. I've said this in the past and I've pissed off some chefs that I wasn't aware of at the time when I first landed.
Right.
So apologies, Quinton from Herringbone. You're a great chef. And he is a great chef. But he, you know, I mean, it's one of those young, uninformed opinions. But overall, I remember going to a very famous fucking food critic and saying... when are you going to come to Adelaide? And his response was, why should I?
Wow.
You know, and that really fucking pissed me off. So, I mean, it really did, because I came here with fresh eyes and I just saw the Adelaide Hills, all the winemaking, the beach, the produce, and how beautiful it is. And that really fucked me off. Like, fuck off, dude. Like, stay in fucking Melbourne then. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, don't fucking come here.
Yeah.
And it took, you know, it took... a very small group of chefs to really convince the people we were working with and young people in particular that the grass isn't that green to go to Sydney or Melbourne. Sure, you know, they're great restaurants that you can get experience. But stopping the brain drain was probably the biggest thing, the biggest hurdle. And, you know, when we did put things on like Lola's Pergola or, you know, Barrio, where these, you know, crazy food events that we weren't handcuffed to a particular set of norms or expectations. When, you know, the natural wine scene blew up probably around 2013, 2014, started to garner attention when Tasting Australia really started to hit its stride, you know, convince young entrepreneurs to stay and open businesses here. And that was the switch. Now, where we are in 2025, we have high-profile national chefs moving here and starting up restaurants because the grass isn't that green, you know? This is such a beautiful and incredibly fertile place for hospitality. And, you know, and you can see it. So, you know, it's been pretty remarkable to see that switch. But, you know, the job's not over yet. I think, you know, people in the eastern states and also international still, I mean, you know, eastern states and international, not also, and look at, you know, South Australia is the drunken uncle of Australia, you know, but there's things about your drunken uncle that actually he's a really fucking nice guy that lives in a beautiful house, you know?
Yep.
So, yeah.
What about you, Lauren? Have you seen much the same?
Yeah, well, when I got here about eight years ago or so, I think they recently just brought in the sort of, how do you call it, smaller liquor license.
Oh, the small bar license.
The small bar license. Yep. So any other time I'd visited, you know, your options were the pub, a takeaway. Or
the Kaz.
Yeah, literally, or like a, you know, a fine dining restaurant or whatever.
Okay, and the Kaz.
Yeah, the Kaz. But yeah, I think I sort of got here as all these sort of smaller bars that were offering food were opening. So I got to see this really nice sort of, you know, your Lee Streets, your Peel Streets, all of those sort of places opening up. And I think that was really exciting for Adelaide. I believe sort of in that time there's been an oversaturation of that style of eating and drinking. But, yeah, what it's sort of done is, you know, some of those places have shut down, and the ones that have that remain are doing better than ever, basically. So, yeah.
Do you think having your cookbook in the Bear has helped with the exposure of Africola? And how did that come about?
Probably not. Who knows? Like, you know, I think we've been lucky with a lot of the exposure that we've gotten from particular celebrities or, you know, musicians or comedians. And so we've been lucky there. I think the book itself, it's kind of like if you know, you know, or if you actually own the copy, you'd be like, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio meme, just pointing it out. Yeah, I mean, I still haven't even seen the show, to be honest. I don't need to live through what I do every day of PTSD and smoking ciggies around the bins. I assume that's what the show is.
Pretty much.
Yeah, and in regards to getting it there, I know one of the producers have eaten here and owned the book, I think, and Maddie Matheson is a mate and a chef I brought out here, two, three times. And he happened to be in the show. So I think there's connection there. I still have I don't know why it's there. I don't know why it remains to be there after 3 seasons. I'm probably season 4, they're going to burn it or,
you know. Like, or something.
So yeah, exactly. We're just happy to be involved. Yeah.
I've noticed probably over the last couple of years, the media likes to do a lot of clickbait articles about hospitality, a lot of bullshit articles. To say, you know, oh, you have to pay $12 for a coffee, like in the next 6 months and that kind of stuff, bringing hospitality down. But what is actually keeping you guys up at night in regards with hospitality and how challenging it is to run a venue? Like, what is the one thing that's the biggest hurdle at the moment to run a successful Africola?
We are a restaurant that has become now an institution of Adelaide. You know, we have broken 12-year records or 11-year records, whatever it is, even up until last week.
Wow.
You know, we've broken many records this year in particular. We're just, you know what, like, there are absolute problems with, you know, the cost of living crisis. You know, produce is at an all-time high, fuel, spend is at its lowest it's ever been, you know, across, you know, everything. We, you know, small businesses get fuck all support, really. Mm-hmm. Tax is ridiculous, even though small business props up. A lot of the national GDP, we're treated like absolute garbage. Mm-hmm. And I will say that. And, you know, it is a terrible thing. I think what keeps me up at night is if we don't have the ability to pay our producers and pay our staff. I mean, I don't pay myself out of this business, you know, at all. Everything we do is reinvested back into it, purely based on the fact that, you know, we have something that we love, that does make money, but, you know, we want, I couldn't imagine saying to my staff, by the way, there's no work tomorrow, or saying, you know, to our producers, sorry, but we can't pay you. Like, that keeps me up at night. That problem, if, thank fuck, if it ever does arrive, hopefully not. Maybe one day it will. Who knows? That is what keeps me up at night.
Okay. Anything for you, Laura?
Everything that Duncan said. Yeah, agreed. Yeah.
What's been the smallest operational change that you've made in the venue that's created the biggest impact?
The separating the drinks menu from our normal menu, and making our menu less design focused and more operational. Right. You know, when you always deal with graphic designers and artists and shit like that,
yeah.
operations and their world are completely far removed. Mm-hmm. Definitely, actually. So actually, you know, for us to go, how can we make an experience better, more logical, slightly less Afrikola in the sense of its madness? The madness is always here, but we don't have to articulate that madness in every facet of everything we do. Let's just make things a little bit more, I don't know, legible. You know, that's actually made a really big difference. And also for us actually having a full packed, beautiful drinks list has really helped my guys on the floor, particularly, you know, my bar manager, who's an absolute legend, a guy called James Copey, really flex on our wine offering, on our cocktail offering, because I would say he is one of Australia's best. And that obviously, you know, then goes over to the customers ordering an extra drink or ordering an extra plate of food than they wouldn't usually have.
Cool.
And you just stop the beatings. Stop the beatings.
Yeah, you know? Just a small change.
When you're so ingrained in this business, when you're so passionate about it, 11 years in, like I often think about people having 10 years in a hospitality venue and then that passion starts to dry up, right? I've seen that a lot. I certainly don't see that today, quite the opposite. How do you balance that passion inside this venue but still balance your life so it isn't the only thing in your life?
For me, I do less services. Okay. Or hardly ever. I'm here pretty much most days, but I do less services. It's the... Now that my kids are older, you know, I missed a lot of their, you know, when they were small, and that sucked. Whereas, you know, now that they're older, you know, having that forced balance, I think COVID was a very good barometer of what is important, what's not important. You know, I was traveling 6 months of the year pre-COVID. You know, it's, you can't, That is not sustainable in any way, shape, or form. I think COVID really helped, be able to force you to balance those things and what is important. And, you know, it's like, has my passion waned for this restaurant? It hasn't. I, you know, obviously you get these kind of, these elements where you think, fuck, you know, am I just bored? Or like, do I just want to just get rid of this shit? Like, and then Brian Ritchie, a friend of mine who's the bassist for the Violent Femmes, was like, you know, Duncan, you know, I wanted to get rid of Violent Femmes, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, whatever, you know, 15 years ago. But then you always think that, you know, it's such a beautiful foundation that you've built everything on top of. You know, they wouldn't be playing in some of the craziest places in the world had he gotten rid of it 15 years ago.
Sure.
So I think that's always in the back of my mind that because it's such a base of goodness for the people involved as well as the community, that's what reignites the passion to keep it the pinnacle of that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about you, Laura?
Money.
Well, it was sold to me when I first started here that I would have the work-life balance, you know, and I was like, yeah, sure, that's never happened anywhere that I've worked before. But I don't know whether it's this place in general or it's Adelaide, but that was possible, and I think that's the reason why I've been here for so long. My passion hasn't waned for the job. It's just changed from, you know, I started here as a chef de party and worked my way up. So, you know, at first it was, you know, being part of a team and coming up with menu items and stuff like that, to now it's like my passion is the staff, you know, getting to see them thrive and getting to see the younger kids cook for their favourite band or, you know, just watching them grow and do well has become my passion rather than, you know, what's put on the plate. You know, because keep them happy and the food's happy, you know? Yeah.
Duncan, how do you know when to say no to something? You get thrown a lot of stuff all the time, both cool, bad, and indifferent. How do you know to say no?
I've got a, my barometer is if I think it's fucking sick or it's really good for community, it's a yes. If it's a no, I will pretty much add a couple of zeros at the end. And then it becomes a yes, which is then annoying because then you've got to do it. but no, I say no to a lot of things. But I think we're just lucky to have a lot of yeses come our way.
Why'd you say yes to this for?
Again, it's a community podcast and you guys are paying me shitloads.
Yes.
I hope you're paying everyone else as much.
I know how we're affording this, really.
You know? Shitloads.
Which leads into my final question, not about money, but what is next for Africola? What's the next sort of maybe 12 months look like in 2026?
Survive the next 12 months.
Yeah. Like,
there's a lot on.
There's a lot on.
Looking at the back end, how do we improve? You know, how do we get more efficiencies? How do we get the kitchen and the food tighter? You know, yeah, I suppose. Look, it's a living and breathing organism. It's just making sure it's happy, alive, and breathing. That's my next 12 months. Yours?
I'll be finishing soon because I got long service.
Yeah. Yeah. Happy this afternoon, isn't it?
Tell me what that was like, Duncan, after 12 months.
It's been awesome having you both on the podcast. So thank you for both saying yes. Thank you, Duncan, thank you for really putting Adelaide on the map again with this venue 11 years ago. It's been an important part for Adelaide to really find its energy back again in hospitality, and I know it will. And it's people like you who we need to thank. So thank you both for your time.
No, thank you very much. Thanks for having us
Thank
on.
You.
This episode of the Ingredients Podcast is brought to you by Tanda, the team helping venues stay ahead of the game. Now, if you want to run a great venue but also stay compliant at the same time, go to hospitality@tanda.com.au. The link is in the bio in the show notes.